Hey everyone, I'm Brian Conley of Hunters HD Gold, and you're listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. This podcast takes a deep dive into what it takes to be a match director, manufacturer, sponsored shooter, or just an everyday shooter trying to win his or her first major. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Welcome back to another episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Today, I'm sitting down with the new president of United States Practical Shooting Association, Yimin Lin. How you doing, man?
Good, Brian. How's it going today?
Man, I am doing great. I have wanted to talk to you before, and this time did not permit. And now we're finally getting a chance today to sit down while we're here at the IPSC Extreme. So
yep.
Lots going on. You've been out here talking to a lot of people and throughout the nation and also in the United States and just kind of helping build the sport, right?
It's been a good match. So thankfully the weather here is proper Florida winter weather as opposed to when the last time I was out here for Ipsic Nationals.
Yeah.
I totally expected that when I signed a contract with Manny Gorka that we would have hurricane weather when we're not supposed to have hurricane weather.
It happens sometimes, but
yes, it does.
The best thing about Florida is it usually does, it goes through pretty quick.
Yeah.
So it does not a big deal. But, you know, I want to know more about you. And I told you this in just a little bit before, because when did you even start getting around a gun? I mean, is this something that, give me a history. What does this even look like for your past?
Well, it's really interesting. So I was born and raised in Kentucky.
Okay, what part?
Western Kentucky, in a little place called Owensboro.
Okay.
Which turns out,
I know where I was. I lived in Bowling Green for a year.
That's right.
And it turns out
there's actually a USPSA club out there.
You were born in Owensboro.
Yes, sir.
So that's a pretty Kentucky type place.
It is definitely Kentucky. So
it is deep in Kentucky.
we're best known for tobacco.
Yeah.
And we got a pretty famous barbecue place down there.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Was that it? And then did you shoot with your family or anything growing up?
It actually wasn't even a glimmer in my mind.
So,
I was always a big military history guy growing up.
Okay. That's something that started in high school?
No, it actually started when I was in kindergarten. So
tell me more about that.
I was always a really big reader when I was young growing up, typical Asian family.
Okay.
And my mom remembers when I first went into the elementary school library, and I think the first book I found was a book about World War I of all things. And that's just kind of where it went from there. So I've always been a really big fan of history.
Mm-hmm.
It's been particularly useful in this time, with what we're going on with the organization to mm-hmm. be able to look back at our history and kind of see, why do we do this? Why do we do that?
Right.
I mean, it's there.
Right.
Right. But it's very much tribal knowledge. You have to find some of the folks from way back in the day when Jesus started shooting
yep.
IPSC and USPSA.
Right.
And then just really, hearing their stories about, well, why did this division come about? Why did this rule come about? Why did this bylaw come about?
Right.
And to just understand, what they were thinking at the time, because I think certainly with the time that you've been in, mm-hmm. we have a very short knowledge of our history, right?
I get that on history.
Been covered about, how many people, what the lifespan is of a typical USPSA person, and it's
right.
A couple of years. So,
right.
Even go back as far as when Ben Steger was, at the top of his game and he was
right.
just rolling over everybody, right? There's mm-hmm. there's not a whole lot of people coming into the sport right now that realize just how good he was back then.
Yeah, and that's a good point, which we'll definitely get into. But was your mom and dad born here or were they?
No.
They
immigrated here in the early 70s.
Okay.
So my mom had graduated from college and she decided to go to graduate school here. So she actually went to get her master's at Illinois State University.
Okay.
And then after Illinois State University, it was a couple of options about where to go work afterwards before she was thinking about getting her doctorate.
Okay.
And so first they went all the way up to Minnesota.
Wow.
And I think that it was just the winter storm of the century, right? So they took one look at that and went, we're not going there.
Right.
And so they went back and ended up in Kentucky. And that's just
right.
kind of where they stayed.
Wow. And you went to, you was in high school in Kentucky?
Yes, sir.
So
Apollo High School, class of 96.
So you were, then go back to kindergarten again, reading books and everything. Was there a lot of other, people of Asian that were around in Owensboro? Because I don't, that's why I asked that question, because I've been to Owensboro.
Yep.
It's pretty
whitey white white.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you were definitely a University of Kentucky person.
Yes.
Or you were a University of Louisville person.
Yes.
So, you know, in my high school class of what, 396, I think there were three Asians.
Right.
There was me. There was a half Japanese kid.
Right.
And we had a Japanese exchange student who just ended up staying there.
Right? Now you picked up on history. Was that because your dad was talking about it, or your mom were talking about the history, or you know, you just don't you know what picked that up?
Really? I think honestly it was just interesting to me.
Okay.
Right.
It's interesting.
It was just interesting, and just the stories and the pictures of, you know, what happens in the past and where we came from that just kind of stuck with me. And I think military history as well, because, well, guns.
Right.
Guns, tanks, you know, all the sort of things that would really pique, you know, sort of a boy's interest back then.
Did you play any sports or anything in high school or anything?
I played Little League baseball. Okay. I was not very good.
Okay.
really not very good. And then in high school, I think at the time, you know, I was in that generation where computers really started to become a thing. Computers, video games, and whatnot.
Yeah.
And when I was a freshman in high school, my mom was like, you are not going to be spending your entire life sitting in front of a computer screen. So she said, you're going to go run track and cross country. So I ended up doing that for about 4 years.
Wow. Did you get pretty good?
No. The genes definitely.
Miserable every step you took.
not so much miserable. I mean, it really was a good experience, especially when, you know, I joined the Marine Corps after college. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it was definitely one of those, like, it was a good thing for me to have gone through that.
Right.
But it, also recognizing that, you know, genetics kind of, I didn't exactly have the right genetic structure for that.
Being in Kentucky, did you have a lot of school friends that wanted to hunt or anything in that area? Because there's a lot of great hunting in Kentucky.
There is a lot of good hunting.
Were you exposed to that at all?
Not at all.
Okay.
You know, I was definitely what you would call kind of the traditional Asian, like just focus on grades.
Okay.
You know, piano, violin. I mean, even the sports thing was kind of an unusual you know, element, just because my mom was like, you are not going to sit around and get fat and lazy. Like,
very, very disciplined family.
Yeah, I can definitely say that. You know, but for a good reason. I mean,
no, I get it.
That is back in the day. So it was, you know, wanting to make sure that
they had the privilege to, you know, be able to come here.
Yes, sir.
And you're not going to waste that opportunity.
Yes.
So I've talked to other people that I know out in California that had the same mentality. You're going to focus and you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And it can be burdensome on your friends because of that, because you don't really get much time to get out. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's one of those things where the other person I talked to is like, you know, if I'm not in school, I'm here and I'm having to study, because that was my focus until, you know, that just happened.
That was pretty much it.
Yeah. Did you, you know, you went through high school, and what did you go to college for?
Political science.
Okay.
So
more learning from the history and trying to get more involved in politics.
Actually, it was more the fact that I realized that in order to get my, degree in history, I had to basically write a 25 page history paper of original research. And I was at a point in my life where I'm like, that's not really my idea of a good time. And so then it was looking at political science. But to be perfectly honest, I probably just picked that major just because all I had to do was take, you know, just write a much shorter paper. And I think it was just trying to get through college at that point. Right.
Were you at a point where you were like so disciplined through that time frame that you were just dead tired of school?
There definitely was a little bit of wariness at that point. I mean, just constant, you know, class education, you know, studying for a really long time. You know, that kind of led to where I went after college, because I just didn't necessarily want to do what the rest of my peers were doing.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I do. I have a younger brother and a younger sister.
Oh, wow. So you're the oldest, huh?
Yes.
Wow. So you say military.
Yes.
You chose the Marines, or the Marines chose you?
Ironically enough, I chose the Marine Corps because the Marine Corps actually had an active recruiting presence at college.
Okay.
It's one of the few places that was actively recruiting. I'm not exactly quite sure why, but they were constantly at Yale putting up, you know, the posters and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And in my senior year, you know, most of my friends, they were either going to go into consulting or investment banking in New York City, or they were going to go back to grad school, or they were, you know, going to do something else. And I really didn't want to do any of that. So, it just seemed like a natural direction to go.
And you went to college at Yale?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That seems like, was that easy to get into, or was there a whole big deal? That's not easy to get into, right?
It isn't. And at the same time, I don't really have a good context to explain that, right?
Okay.
I mean, there is, you know, Yale isn't just all, you know, New England, you know, having gone to private schools type stuff. They do pick, at the time, they picked a number of people that were just sort of, hey, I'm the first from my family. I'm the first from my town.
Right.
And I happen to fall into the latter category.
That's awesome. That's awesome. 4 years at Yale back in the 90s?
Yes, sir.
So politics wasn't as strong as it was now back in college, right?
Or was it was still there. I don't think it was as controversial as it is now.
Okay.
I mean, I think what really sold me to Yale was Yale actually does interviews with every candidate, regardless of, you know, whether they're actually going to get in. Mm-hmm. And I had someone back in Owensboro who was a Yale graduate. It turned out that he was a classmate with Governor Pete Wilson. They both joined the Marine Corps.
Okay.
And it was just a really wonderful situation where he was able to talk about his experience at Yale in the 50s, you know, talk a little bit about his experience in the Marine Corps. And it just, you know, that alumni network is just really strong. And to just sell the school in that way rather than just, you know, hey, we're like the top of this or the top of that. I think that was something that really struck home with me.
Was mom and dad happy about going to Yale, or just Western Kentucky was right down the street? That's why I asked that question. I lived in Bowling Green, which was where WKU was, you know, with Big Red. So I didn't know if that wasn't part of the plan, huh?
No, no. I spent a couple of summers in Western Kentucky because they had some summer programs there.
Right.
So spent a couple summers in Bowling Green, and that was, you know, Bowling Green's a really good place. Again, Corvette Museum's down there.
So. It is. I was in Bowling Green back in the 90s, and it was back at the Greenwood Mall in Bowling Green, in a place called Video Concepts.
Yep.
And I worked there for a year and a half before I transferred back to Birmingham. I was a problem solver. So when I went somewhere, there was a problem with the store. I pretty much went in and played human resources, cleaned it up, turned it around, and went somewhere else. That's what I did for a long time.
Familiar.
No. Really?
There is a lot of employment available for problem solvers.
Yes. And that's what I did. I was a firefighter. I was putting out fires everywhere I went. So not literal words of firefighter, but you know, in the retail world, I lived in Bowling Green for a while, and it was like, there's not much there. So I ate, drank, and slept in retail because there wasn't nothing else to do.
Not at the time.
So you go to Yale.
Yes.
And there's a presence there for the Marine Corps to be recruited.
So the Marine Corps did actually recruit out of there. There actually is now a Naval ROTC detachment at Yale.
Okay.
There wasn't at the time. So the only ROTC detachment, there was a couple of people I knew that were with the Air Force ROTC out of University of Connecticut Stores, but there wasn't an actual ROTC. But the Marine Corps officer recruiting programs out of, ironically, Manhattan, they came up. It was just part of their territory. So the guy that was in charge there would come up every so often, put up some posters and just sit and, you know, he was pretty open-ended about it. You know, there wasn't a sense of, hey, I'm going to try to sell you on this, but if you had questions, he was available.
And based on you having going there for a degree, they were talking to you about going into like an officer's program, I take it.
Yep.
So that was that interesting to you as well?
It was. And I think mentally what I thought was at the time was, well, I went to a really difficult school. And I think the Marine Corps had a really good marketing campaign of like, you know, we're the toughest and the strongest, whatever. So I just thought, okay, well, I guess I'll just go join the Marine Corps.
Now, coming from a family that immigrated here, taking care and seizing an opportunity, school, and when you think you're done, more school.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
I'm just going based on just what you hear. Then all of a sudden you tell mom and dad that I'm going to the Marine Corps. This could be an easy conversation, right?
It was an easier conversation than I expected.
Okay.
You know, my parents were surprisingly understanding of just, okay, what, you know, if that's what you feel is best for you and not necessarily, oh, you're not going to be a doctor or lawyer or going to go to grad school or anything like that. So there were obviously some concerns, you know, being in the military and, but it wasn't a knockdown drag out like, oh, it's our way or the highway.
Right.
There were some questions that were asked. And at the end of the day, it was okay. You know, if that's what you want to do, then so be it.
All right. What did you want to go into in the military? Because I know sometimes you get choices and those choices may not always work out, but what were your goals to go when you went into it?
Probably what all the marketing says. I mean, you know, the old commercials were back then of fighting, you know, lava warriors and dragons. So, of course, yep, everybody joins the Marine Corps wanting to be an infantry officer of some sort, something right, in combat arms. I ended up being a logistics officer. So I was still with, I still ended up being with the infantry, mm-hmm, but it was more of, okay, well, let's just make sure that, you know, everything gets to where it needs to so that the infantry can complete their mission. So,
and how many years did you do the military? I mean, Marines?
Roughly four years and 7 months.
So 4 years, 7 months. Mm-hmm. Did you ever, you know, this year's in the '90s, wasn't a lot going on behind the scenes worldwide, was there?
So I joined in October of 2000.
Okay. And you're back in 2000. Excuse me.
So figured, you know, it was just going to be, you know, get some work experience and then go back to grad school. And I was actually in the middle of my logistics officer training when 9/11 happened. And I think at that point it was, Okay, we're not doing what I thought we were going to do.
Right. Now, 9/11 was a big deal for a lot of things. And a lot of people jumped in the military to, you know, for lack of better words, revenge,
right,
be a part of this process to show them what we're made of. Thank goodness there's people to do that. But what was your role when all that happened?
So when September 1st happened, I was literally in the middle of, taking a test. And, you know, one of the Marines runs in and says, oh my God, they just flew planes in the fucking tower.
Wow.
And so we're sitting here at Camp Lejeune, Camp Johnson at the time. And we just kind of all look up, and the master sergeant that was teaching class, you know, was just very calm about it. It's like, look, there's not a whole lot we can do about this right now. You can only control what you can control.
Right.
Like, let's just finish the test and then we'll see what happens afterwards. So, it was a really good calming moment at the time to go, okay, something really important just happened historically, mm-hmm, but.
Did you really think it was that big of a, I mean, did you think it was part of history at that point, or is it just too surreal to look? Because you didn't.
It was a little bit of both, because I had actually just been back up to New York City to visit a couple of friends of mine. And I remember this old black and white photo I have of, you know, the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. So it was, oh my gosh, it was maybe 6-7 months before September 11th happened, where it's like, oh, I was just there and now it's not there.
Wow.
And I don't think we really knew what was going to happen at that point.
Right. Did you ever get called to do anything or go anywhere with, you know, any to help out with any of that when all that started?
No,
they
I was still
pretty
in,
quick.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. I mean, I was still in training at that time. Mm-hmm. So November of 2001 is when I reported to my first unit in 29 Palms, California, and kind of knew at that point that it wasn't going to be your typical peacetime rotation.
Right.
So, you know, all the maps of every country in Central Asia were up. And yeah, there was a fair amount of, okay, well, what's the plan? I mean, it took about another year and a half before anything actually happened, but there was definitely the sense of, okay, we're not just going to go about our business as normal.
Like, it's like, this is not what we signed up for in recruiting class.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is what it is.
Right.
So,
right. Wow. So 4 years, 7 months.
Yes.
And you had opportunities to stay, of course, right?
There was. It was time to go at the time.
Okay.
So, was part of the invasion force in Iraq in 2003.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
So, again, that was just, it was very surreal. I mean, it felt like we were going to the Super Bowl. I guess that's a good way to put it. You know, you've been training for your whole life, and you finally get to participate in this. And going to war is different. I really don't want to say that there was anything that was that I thought was particularly crazy the first time around, just because we just didn't know what to expect, and it was very different. You know, certainly not like what you see in the old history books about, you know, getting in lots of encounters. I mean, the Iraqis pretty much were like, okay, like, we're glad you're here. We're kind of tired of Saddam,
right?
But everything that happened after that, I think, was definitely unexpected. You know, we ended up staying around for a couple extra months, longer than we anticipated. We came back in September of 2003, and we're just like, yay, we did it. We went to the Super Bowl. Like, we did our part for country.
Right.
And then we got told we're going back in like 5 months.
Wow.
So, So I went right back out again in January of 2004. We ended up in this place on the Iraqi-Syrian border, and it was a very different experience the second time around. I mean, the first time, you know, we just, it really just felt like a weird party, of course, right, of sorts, because there, you know, there's still combat and whatever, but right, you know, it just really felt like we were in some ways it felt like we were almost just armed tourists, okay, in Iraq. Second time around is when things started getting a little bit hairier. And I think that was about the time that people realized, okay, this is not, we're not just going to roll over these people.
It's getting serious.
It was definitely getting serious. Right. I mean, just within the seven months that we were there, you know, you sort of started off with sort of like the JV team, right? Mm-hmm. Like D-class terrorists, right? Yeah. Yeah. You know, they didn't really know what they were doing and they made a lot of mistakes. And then by the time we got to the end of 2004, maybe September, October, they learned really fast and wow, they got significantly more lethal. You know, Matthew Gunlach from the Bullets podcast, the retired Marine. Yes. I mean, he actually was part of the unit that relieved mine, I think, in 2004. And yeah, things were just a lot different by that point. The insurgents gotten really good at coming up with really unique ways to basically come after us.
Right.
And it was, you know, and I think historically the next, what is it, from 2004 to 2008 was just, it was a difficult time.
Very bad times. Yeah. Dude, you have a family at this time? Are you still, you know, solo?
Still solo. I mean, yeah. I got married, had two kids.
Yeah.
You know, that marriage didn't work out. So,
a lot of first marriages don't. A lot of second marriages don't.
Well,
that's why I'm on my third.
I wish there was a lot more. I wish there was a lot more training when it came to getting married.
Right.
I think, you know, it's something that's very important in people's lives, and yet for the most part, we kind of go into it.
Oh, it's
unprepared.
No, yeah. Women that, you know, men that go after women and women go after men. It's not about a business relationship or even, it's just about what you feel at that moment. Decisions are made.
Yeah.
I was married the first time when I was 21 and less than national average at the time, 4 years and no kids, and I was out, you know, mm-hmm, and it was easy. And then, you know, it's just life changes for everybody. As you get older, you find out more and more what you want. And now with the social media world, I can't imagine. My son's 22, and I said, yeah, good luck, because I don't know how it's going to work out for anybody at this age group, how it's going to work with marriage and everything else in the future.
It's definitely different.
So, but a lot of lessons to be learned.
Yes, sir.
So you get out of the military, and I could be, you know, all kind of stories we could drop there about, you know, living, trying to be married and stuff. But, you know, you get out of the military, and did you, you know, your thank you for your service and everything that you did to do that, and that's amazing to me. What was next for you? What was on that plate? You were in California. Is that when you stayed in California?
Yes. So okay. I stayed in California at that point. I honestly wasn't sure what I was going to do at that point.
Right.
So I took a couple of positions in the tech industry in Silicon Valley. And, you know, again, at that point, it's just a job.
Okay.
So I think sometime, I was just trying to make my way through. Okay. Now what?
Yeah. Did you know your parents, they're not Owensboro anymore. They come out to California with you?
They moved to California after I had my kids.
Nice.
So they, at that point, they had retired and they wanted to basically be near the grandkids. So
right.
They moved out to California, I think, in 2015 or 16.
Okay. Neat. That's been a big help, I'm
it
sure,
has been.
Because my sister decided to, you know, have a litter. She's got five, which is why I was one and done, because I was like, this is way too much, but
yeah,
she's needy. But that's okay. Everything is great. Well, my mom had moved from Tuscaloosa when we all lived together. She lived up in North Carolina. I said, I don't need your help. She's got the litter. You need to go help her.
So there's something to be said about the extended family being able to help.
Yes, most definitely. I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, I don't know how my sister gets through on stuff like that. But that was her life's choices, not mine. So,
right.
You know, so you're doing in Silicon Valley.
Yep.
How long did that work out for you?
From about 2008 until probably 2016.
Okay. So when did you find out about the shooting sports through all this process? You know, we How did that work?
So I actually found out about it in like late 2013, 2014. So, you know, I really didn't.
In California.
Yes.
That's what I want people to understand. You found out about the shooting sports in California.
Yes.
That people would live in Alabama, because that's where I live, would go, there's no way they even have guns in, you know, California, until you're educated to know that's not a bad place to have guns. You just right. got all kind of the hoops to jump through. But continue.
It's definitely different. So, you know, when I got out of the military at that point, you know, that was really when the first time I handled firearms and, you know, mm-hmm. just sort of got bit by the bug. And I still wanted to stay involved in it. So I was mostly dealing with what I knew. So the world I knew at the time was sort of the tactical defensive community.
Okay.
So went and, you know, got training where I could, you know, Frank Proctor, you know, Mike Pannone, Pat Rogers at the time, mm-hmm. you know, one of the last Magpul classes before Chris Costa and Chris Costa split away.
Okay.
And so when I was, that's actually how I found out about it, because there's this guy, Gabe White. So Gabe White is this fellow up in Oregon, and he wanted to become a better concealed carry person. So he was told, and if you wanted to get better as a concealed carry person, you should get into competitive shooting. So of course, his first thought was, well, let me go to IDPA because okay. it's defensive.
Of course.
And that was when appendix carry was really starting to become its own thing. And of course, he finds out, well, you can't appendix carry in IDPA at the time. So he went, okay, well, I'm not going to do that. And so then he found out about USPSA. So he actually kept a very detailed training diary of when he first started in USPSA and when he became, you know, how it developed as a concealed carry permit holder. I mean, we're talking about a guy who, I mean, he lost a lot of weight to get healthier. You know, he initially started off concealed carry at like 3:30, 4 o'clock, and then he realized that appendix carry was more efficient. I mean, you're talking about a guy at the time who was basically a masterclass limited competitor with his Glock 34 carry rig. So he was shooting minor, right. appendix carry. Everything was for concealment. Wow. I remember the first time I actually saw him shoot after I got involved in USPSA for about 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. You're talking about a guy that, for where he was at, shooting limited minor from concealment at that much of a disadvantage to right. what the game says, he was incredibly good. I mean, he could do sub-second draws from concealment at the buzzer and get alpha hits at 7 yards.
Wow. When you went in your first competitive match, what was it like? Because you had training in military, and it's correct. I don't guess it's anything like USPSA. So what was it like when you went to your first, you know, class the USPSA match to be able to see that?
So my first match was actually, I came into it with no preconceptions.
Okay.
So that was one thing Gabe was very important in stressing, was that, you know, hey, this is a very different environment. This is a game. Mm-hmm. Something I remember even Frank Proctor talked about.
Right.
So Frank Proctor would talk about competitive shooting. I mean, the guy was a GM. And that's the story he told us about what it was like being in competitive shooting was something that really stuck with me. So it was, mm-hmm. don't come in with any preconceived notions of I'm going to wipe the table, everybody. So Frank Proctor's first match, he said, you know, at that point, you know, he was a special forces guy. He's thinking, you know, this is my life. Yeah. I should just be able to come in and just wipe the floor with these people. And right. he just talks about getting his butt kicked right. by, you know, bakers, candlestick makers, and like 80-year-old doctors, right? right? He's like, well, wait a minute. Like, I'm a special forces guy. I'm like, why am I getting my ass kicked right. by these people? But Frank, you know, Frank was mature enough to kind of look at the results and go, okay, maybe there is something here.
Right.
And so I came with no expectations.
What year was that when you first got in USPS?
I think it was 2014. My membership, I think, will say 2015 or so, but I think 2014 was when I went to my first match, and it was a very welcoming environment. It was very much the club I first started off was more of an introductory club than anything else.
Okay.
So the things that we don't think about when it comes to practical shooting, right? Like showing up and building and, you know, the fact that it's not just, hey, you're just running around shooting all the time.
Right.
It was a very friendly social environment. You know, we came in and said, hey, we're glad you're here. Here's a couple things you'll need to know. And then by the way, you know, this is when you need to be here to help build, to help, you know, change the stages around. Mm-hmm. So it was a really nice intro into the practical shooting world.
Did you fall in love with it as the first time you went, or is this something that kind of worked over time to enjoy?
It was definitely at love at first sight.
Okay.
You know, I showed up at my first match with a Glock 19, that had a Vickers mag release and a Vickers slide stop. So at the time, that put me in limited because you couldn't make that changes. I showed up, you know, with some Raven concealment, like it was in a Raven concealment holster, Raven concealment mags, all the stuff I had from the tactical side.
Did you have your thigh holster at the time?
No, no. I knew better by that point than to have a thigh holster.
Well, it's legal now.
It so is.
Bring it back.
It is. But, you know, it was, I could definitely see right away, like, okay, like there's something here to make you better. And really the social environment was really what brought it in. Right. That everybody was so welcoming. It wasn't like, who are you? Like,
You said you were a little bit of a loner a little bit through high school and some things like that. Did you see that you didn't feel the same thing as being a loner when you got involved with the sport? Did it take you back more to having the camaraderie
it did.
That you had in the military?
It did. I mean, this is probably the closest I found with, you know, you meet the very best of society in some ways, you know, wherever you go. I mean, you've traveled quite a bit since you started your involvement in the sport. And for me, going to work matches, you know, you really get a chance to meet people that you wouldn't otherwise run into.
Oh, 100% agree with that. How easy was it to get a gun in California back then? In California, it's easy to take a gun there and go shoot.
Right.
But it's not easy to buy one. So what was that like and what kind of obstacles did you have to go through? And when did you buy your first gun in California?
I think it actually was the Glock 19 I showed up at the match with.
Okay.
Otherwise I had the guns that I brought in when I moved in, through the Marine Corps.
Okay.
It is possible that at the time it was still possible to get the competition guns.
Yeah.
You had to jump through a couple more hoops
more
than anything else. So, being able to buy from a dealer, that was obviously, there was only a list that you could work off of.
Yep.
But if there are people, you know, who already own those guns, that could be transferred without any issue.
When you first started wanting to handle guns and stuff like that, was this something that mom and dad were okay with, or did you have guns in the household growing up for protection in Kentucky, or was this all new to them?
It was all new. Ironically enough, you know, when I went to the Marine Corps, I thought, just like anybody else, hey, I need to learn how to use a gun, right?
Okay.
And so I had no idea of where to get started. So I actually called the Owensboro Police Department. Now, you can imagine now if somebody says, hey, I want to go load and shoot a gun, they're going to be like, oh, hold on, we're going to be right by your place. But at the time, you know, I called the police department and said, hey, I'm getting ready to join the Marine Corps. I'd like to, you know, I really would think I should, you know, learn how to use a firearm first. Mm-hmm. And they actually directed me to the fish and wildlife guys.
Okay.
So they gave me this guy's number. I called him up and said, hey, you know, I just want to learn how to handle firearms. And again, it was just it's a really interesting anecdote about how welcoming the Second Amendment people are to those who just want to learn. So this guy just says, hey, come on by my house. So I'm like, okay. So I go drive all the way out to this guy's land in, I forget, Livermore or something like that, Livermore, Kentucky. And this dude had a bay built in his backyard. He had berms built up. And it was so nice. He literally pulled everything out of his safe. Mm-hmm. So everything from a revolver to a semi-auto shotgun, a pump shotgun, an AR, a 9mm, a 357. And it was his own ammo. And we just laid it out on the table and said, okay, you know, went over some of the safety rules. And then he just said, here's what a revolver feels like. I shot that and I shot all the different firearms. Mm-hmm. Turned out this guy was actually a National Guard sniper out in Bosnia back in the day.
Oh.
But it was, you know, I think that's the thing that I think I was always really fortunate with, is that in every step of the way, from learning how to use a firearm to getting involved in practical shooting, you know, there were just really wonderful people that just said, hey, we're happy to have you here.
Right.
You know, very much the same thing we see in practical shooting, where it's like, what do I do at my first match? And we'll literally just throw our own guns and ammo at them and say, we're just happy to see you here. Like, come on down.
That makes sense. You know, when you're in a situation where, you know, you're starting to go to matches. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, you're seeing this is starting to click. This is starting to become it started off as a hobby to you?
Yeah.
Okay. So when did it go from a hobby to a sport for you?
Probably about 3 years in.
Okay. So that put year 17?
Yeah. Probably about 16 or 17.
Okay.
So I was still trying to figure out my way in 15. Mm-hmm. 2000. And then about that time, that's when I really wanted to get involved with the sport beyond just being a competitor. So that was when I really started working matches. And
that's like when you 15, became 16. An RO yes. for the first time and wanted to start you traveling. Because I remember when I met you, it was in 18. Because that's when I started traveling. And mm-hmm. when I started traveling the first year, it was up the East Coast.
Yep.
And you were all over the East Coast. That's one thing. You were traveling a lot on that side. What made you want to travel, you know, from California to other areas to start doing that, you know, the RO, traveling RO like you did? Because you did a lot of matches when I first met you.
I think it was just wanting the wanderlust. I think that's very much the same thing, you know, that you've experienced, where it's just,
I
want
it.
To see what places are like around the country.
Right.
I kind of liked that aspect of sort of the sales retail world.
Okay.
Not necessarily the daily grind of like, oh my God, why aren't you meeting your numbers?
Right.
But just being able to travel around the country and see what other parts of the sport are like. The first match I really traveled outside of California was basically the Manny and Gorka's match.
Right.
Before they were here.
Right.
So the Area 6 match, I think in 2017?
Okay.
2016 or 2017. That's when they were having the Area 6 match down at the OK Corral.
Okay.
And I just saw that they were looking for help, and I thought, why not?
Okay. And you know, through that process, you've learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Learned a lot of people. On everything else. You didn't have any desire when you first got started to be any kind of leader with USPSA at that time, did you?
I'll be honest, at the time, I just wanted to work matches. And as I started going, I was really thinking about the RO track more than anything else.
You know,
be an RO, at a major match, be a CRO, mm-hmm. Be a CRO at Nationals. Then I thought at some point that, okay, you know, I was just really thinking the Rangemaster track more than anything else.
Right.
It really wasn't until about 2019 or 20 that,
right.
you know, this idea of even going, well, wait, there's more than just possibly being a range master to help the sport more than anything else.
When you're traveling like that and you've got, you know, family helping you with, you know, kids growing up and everything else, you know, did you find that is more, you know, still working, of course, just vacation time, doing it when you can? What'd that look like?
So I think after, 2016, I think at that point I chose basically to be a stay-at-home parent.
Okay.
That was something that my wife at the time was okay with. So it wasn't as difficult as it seemed.
Right.
So I, quite frankly, was probably living the typical American dream, you know, just leverage your credit cards.
Yeah.
And, you know, in service of something that you love until something happens.
Right.
So I wasn't necessarily taking vacation time. It was just very much getting by with, you know, what the matches were offering. And at that point, you know, my wife's family, my ex-wife's family, they were living in the area. My parents were living in the area. So it just happened to be a very unique set of circumstances where me being gone wasn't necessarily a huge impact, because there was a huge safety net.
Right.
To help watch the kids.
Did your ex-wife at the time have any issues with guns or anything? Or is that just how that education go there?
She wasn't the biggest fan of it. Okay. But, you know, at the same time, it became an evolutionary process where, hey, as long as, you know, everything is stored appropriately and then the kids don't have access to it, then, you know, it was an adjustment.
Well, the reason I asked that question, when I was dating Sherry, when I first met her, I had a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't care for the motorcycle at all. She had her preconceptions about it being dangerous and everything else. And in the real world, they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot about, you know, I put from 0 miles to 64,000 miles. I rode a motorcycle a lot for a long time. And when I met her, it was like, okay, put it in the garage and I didn't ride it anymore. So people make decisions based on, you know, what lifestyle choices you make to be with certain people. So the reason I asked that question, just, you know, Was there times where you ever thought about, you know, not having to worry about the fight and put up the guns, you know, or not fight, but discussions?
Honestly, not really.
Yeah, because me and Sherry never fought. It was just,
It was definitely a topic of concern. I mean, the irony is you talk about motorcycles. And so when I first got married, I was thinking about riding motorcycles at the time.
Right.
And it was a hard no.
That's where everything
stopped. It was a hard no.
Right.
So instead I took up skydiving.
What? okay, I didn't know that. That's fine. That's why I do the show.
skydiving.
Yeah.
What made you want to do, did you do that in the military?
No.
Okay. So where did this adrenaline desire come from?
It wasn't so much an adrenaline thing. So my, the second job I had up in Silicon Valley, there was a fellow that I was working with, and he was in Force Recon in the reserves.
Okay.
And he was just a mountain of a man, like one of those Scandinavian big bone. The guy was like 44 at the time and could basically run circles around everybody.
Okay.
Right. And we just got to talking about skydiving because he was a master jumper. He was a jump master, mm-hmm. and we just kept talking about it. And at some point I was just like, you know, I really want to try out skydiving. So I did. And so my first jump, I remember I landed a little bit too hard, kind of bounced off my butt.
Well, you were tied with this guy too, right?
What's that?
You were tandem together.
No.
Huh?
So in skydiving, there's a couple different ways to actually get your A license.
You jump for the first time without being tied to somebody?
No. Yeah.
Okay. Huh?
Yeah. So, well, it wasn't...
You jumped out of a plane.
Not by myself. So okay. What they did was they basically have this thing called... So there's two different tracks, right? So there's one where you basically tandem jump and then you work your way up to solo.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get. I'm not jumping out by myself the first time. I may decide, I'm just going to black out.
The route that I went through was actually called advanced free fall. So
okay.
My first jump, I actually had two people basically hanging on to me
okay.
to help with the,
when
the
you free fall out.
Flight. I actually didn't pass out.
Just kidding.
But no, so the first time I jumped, there were actually two people basically helping me with the flight.
Okay.
Right. To make sure I was stable, to kind of walk you through all the different things you have to go through.
Right.
But then when it came to the actual shoot release, like I was on my own at that point. So I remember my first flight came down. And the irony of it is that the jump field that I was at, right next to it, was a USPSA club.
No.
That's so funny. So I would go, so I went there and I just would fly over the bays and I'm going like, oh, that's kind of cool. They're shooting right now. And the irony is that, you know, then I went from skydiving.
This is not where you want one over the berm.
Yeah. So I ended up, you know, just the irony is that, you know, a couple years later when I wasn't able to do the skydiving thing anymore for schedule reasons, I was basically right across the street at the range taking my RO and CRO class with Troy McManus at the time.
Wow.
But yeah, my first flight, I kind of bounced off my butt, and my ex-wife was filming at the time, and she had somebody standing next to her, and she went, oh, wow, like, you know, that seemed a little rough. And then my ex-wife at the time said, yeah, that's his first jump. She's like, what? She's like, well, it was either that or a motorcycle. And then she went, oh, okay. Because my ex-wife at the time was about 7-8 months pregnant.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Wow. There's so many things wrong with this with this scenario of you're, you know, I get it, motorcycle, but jumping out of a plane, you know, insurance is paid up, right?
Well, so what was really interesting about skydiving was that, ironically, it's very similar to what we have to deal with here in practical shooting.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Most people, when they think of skydiving, it's very much like, you know, what is it? Point Break, right? Just a bunch of like, hey, we don't care. Hey, bro, do whatever.
Yeah.
That's actually a lot of that is just to help you be centered with yourself. It's more of trying to take your mind off of, you know, what some people would think is a very dangerous thing. But before every jump, you actually have to go through essentially your ground checks, just like you would flying. And it's a very different mentality at that point. So it might be a lot of the, hey, bro, hang loose, whatever. But then before you go to your jump, it's like, that face is gone, and it's, what are you going to do?
All right.
Okay, you know, we're gonna climb up to 13,500 feet. At 13,500 feet, the first thing we're gonna do is you're gonna take a look down to basically make sure that the jump space is clear.
Yeah, the so ground,
that check is always there.
The ground's there.
But it's a ground check just to make sure right. that there's nothing else in the area.
Right.
Right. So it's actually a very regimented process that you don't really notice the first time. Okay. It's very by the book. I mean, George Jones being a helicopter pilot, it's very much like that.
All right.
Okay. Tell me exactly what you're going to do. Okay, we're going to climb 13,500 feet. We're going to do the ground check, make sure the space is clear. You know, we're going to do, everybody's going to do the equipment checks beforehand to make sure all the rigs are on. When you put your rig on, you're going to basically double check that your, you know, your reserve chute is functioning. You're going to check that your primers are functioning. You're going to check that your altimeter is working. Okay, what are you going to do at that point? Okay, once I initiate my drop, I'm going to be in a controlled free flight for approximately 4 to 5 minutes. Be looking at your altimeter approximately once every 10 to 20 seconds. When are you going to release your chute? Okay, I'm going to release my chute at this altitude. What do you do if this and happens? And so it's literally, you know, okay, what do you see if you see this in your chute? Okay, I got to do this. What if you do if you see this in your chute? I got to do this. What if you see this in your chute? Like, okay, I'm pulling my emergency. And it's a very serious endeavor at that point, because
right. It
is a very serious sport, you know, very much like what we talk about here in practical shooting, where we say, okay, like, what are you going to do? Okay,
yeah. This
is what make ready is. And then once you get up in the plane, then, you know, look, I mean, even my buddy who had like hundreds of jumps, you know, someone that I thought was just like the manliest man in the world, even he was like, I would still get the shakes, because there's just that adrenaline.
Right.
But then once you're out of the plane, you basically get approximately 3 to 5 seconds of, oh my God, I'm falling.
That's me. Let's continue.
but then after that, you have to be present in the moment.
Yeah.
And skydiving, scuba diving, practical shooting, I think those are the three things I've participated in my life where you have to be present in the moment.
Right.
Right. You can't be thinking like, okay, well, what am I going to do 5-10 minutes later? Mm-hmm. Like, you're in the moment.
Right.
And you have to, you know, and the more relaxed you are and the more less conscious you are about what's going on, mm-hmm. the better everything goes. You know, in practical shooting, you know, the more subconscious you are when you run a stage,
right.
that's generally when you're better. I mean, Steve Anderson talks about that mental game.
Yep.
Skydiving, same thing. You know, you're very much focused on the moment. You know, you're almost in a tunnel where, yes, the wind is blowing by your ears at, you know, terminal velocity, but I don't ever actually remember hearing any of that. I just remember looking at the horizon, being present, being at peace.
Yeah. I've parasailed before. It's just quiet, you know, because you're up there and you don't hear all the street noise or anything mm-hmm. else, but just not doing the big jump. So how many jumps did you do?
16 or 18. I think I was all the way up. I think I was all the way up to doing my solo jumps, and I needed to do some hop and pops, which is basically you go up to 3,000 feet and just jump out and basically have to pull your chute right away. And then there's a couple of night jumps you have to do. And then I would have had my A license.
Wow. But the shooting sports happened.
Then the shooting sports happened.
You know, when you get into the shooting sports, I think I asked this question, but I don't know if we really got to it. Start off as a major hobby.
Yeah.
Expensive hobby.
Yes.
When did it turn into the sport for you? When did it become, you know, or did it ever become a sport? Did you find yourself as a supporter of the sport based on being an RO and traveling so much?
There was probably about 2 years between 2016 and 2018 or 19.
Okay.
Where it was, the effort was a little bit more serious about trying to be competitive.
Okay.
And then just working the matches. I mean, there is a real trade-off. I mean, there is a real trade-off for someone to be truly competitive in the sport.
Right.
There, you have to choose.
It's to pass, just, yes. Because no were you in a situation where you realized that you weren't going to be able to put the time in to be, or you didn't have that competitive drive, or you just wanted to be just a supporter with the passion behind it? What did that look like?
I think really it was a shift in what I found, what I got from the sport.
Okay.
So you do have folks who come in and they just have this incredible competitive drive, and then they get to a certain point and then they're just like, okay, in order for me to become, you know, a truly competitive GM, like, I have to put in a significant amount of effort.
Correct.
And it is a discretionary income sport. It's a discretionary time sport. And not everybody can, you know, put that effort in. And so when they reach that point, there's really an inflection point where you go, okay, well, why am I still doing this?
Right.
I reached that a little bit sooner where I knew I wasn't, you know, necessarily going to be like truly, truly competitive. But by that point in my career path, I got much more value from just what we're doing right now.
Right.
So the shooting was still important, but it wasn't the primary driver of why I was going to work and shoot these matches.
Right.
It was really the people, to see the people and to it was different. It was a different set of motivations.
Yep. So you're doing an RO, you're traveling all around. How long did you travel? How many, you know, how many matches,
from
how many years
2016 travel? Till 2022, that would have been close to 47 to 48 major matches in that time period. Mm-hmm. Everything from level twos to area matches to nationals. Yeah, until we got to where we're at now.
And, right.
You know, again, I think it's another inflection point to go, okay, based on where I'm at right now, mm-hmm. you know, is working a match, you know, the most important thing that I need to be doing?
Right.
As opposed
well,
to.
Well, you know, because, yeah, so, you know, when you're working matches, everything's great. Then all of a sudden, you know, the Foley debacle started happening.
Right.
And then we realized there's going to have to be another president.
Right.
And then were you led at that point to say, you know, hey, I've met a lot of people. This might be a good move for me next. Was it ever a political thought, or was it just like, okay, this is my next level to help? Because that's a big moment there to make a decision like that. You know, what was your motivation behind the decision to go for that?
2019, I think, is when I first started thinking that this might actually be a thing.
Okay.
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I mean, that was Jody and I were just sitting there in Talladega at one point, and she turns and looks at me and goes, you know, I think you'd be a really good president. I mean, and at that point, I honestly really had not even strongly considered, you know, the issue.
Did you ask her why? Or do you remember that conversation going much further? Was it just small talk?
I think it was more small talk than anything else.
Okay.
I think there was something about, you know, being connected with the membership and just this understanding of, like, you've met so many people.
Oh, I saw you everywhere for years when you were traveling. And that's why I asked that question. So,
but even at the time, you know, I was just thinking, okay, well, you know, the next election would have been last year.
Yeah.
Right. So the seed was planted, and it was a little bit of a stronger thought at the time, but it was, okay, well, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it
right.
in 2022. And then, you know, things happened the way they were, and it just sort of accelerated things quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, and that's what happens sometimes. We have a way that's set out for us how to do things, and then things, you know, turn and go in other directions. Because I don't want to get into much, you know, detail. However, I want to ask this, you know, all you were doing for almost like 5 years was traveling and doing what you did. And then you got elected as intern.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what was your thought process like in your mind when it was all taken away? Not the details, but just your lifestyle was taken away. What was that like for you to go through? Because that's all you knew.
It was difficult, I think. It was definitely difficult. My buddy Robert Wyatt talks about the hero's journey, right? Mm-hmm. So there's kind of you're starting your journey, you get to a point, you fall, and you kind of, you're in the wilderness, and you sort of learn what it means to be, you know, a man or whatever analogy you want. And then you sort of, you know, climb your way back up. You know, there was, you know, I'm not going to say that I just was like, okay, whatever.
I would not expect you to say that. I wanted to know, you know, was it tough? Was it hard?
It was not easy.
Okay.
There was definitely a certain amount of frustration into how things turned out. There's always this period where you think, okay, what could I have done better? You know, hey, it's not my fault. You know, all the stages of grieving and loss that you sort of go through.
Yeah.
But then once you go through that, I think what really helped is really what the sport is fundamentally about, which is the club level, right?
Okay.
The people that we meet at the club level, and you're able to kind of take a step back and you go shoot matches. And you're not necessarily thinking about, you know, wanting to score the best. You're just there with the friends that really keep us coming back.
Okay. Right.
And I think that's a transition that some people find sooner than others, where the competitive juices, the wanting to do your best, that can only take you so far. Once you reach that point, well, why do we keep coming back? And,
right.
I'm reminded of a good friend of mine who basically said once, you know, I came for the bill drills and I stayed for the people. And I think that's really what helped support me through that process. You know, that time away from the sport, that time in the wilderness was the people.
Yeah, because you're in a situation where you knew everybody, you were talking to everybody, your friends were there, everybody was there, and all of a sudden it's gone.
You definitely, when you're at your lowest, that's usually when you figure out who your true friends are.
Why did you decide to stick it out and just not go do something else? Because I would think that had to go through your mind.
Well, there's definitely a certain amount of stubbornness involved. Okay. But it was going to those club matches and talking to all the friends that I knew, you know, the people that I knew around the country. Where
did you find out who your real friends were?
Some more than others. Yeah. You know, the ones who will basically stick by you.
Yep.
You know, no matter what.
Yep.
I know there's the type of friends that'll be with you when things are good, and they're the type of friends that will come pick you up from a jail in Mexico.
Yep. Yes.
And no questions asked.
That's right. Exactly. What is that
one scene from The Town where I forget, one of the characters walks in and says, you know, you can't ask me any questions. We're going to do some bad things, but I need to borrow your car.
Yeah.
And the guy responds, okay, well, who's driving?
Yeah.
You know, those kinds of friends.
Right.
And I think, honestly, it was for the people, for the sport, and just going, you know what, there's still something there. Like, the reason why I ran and got elected the first time, like, that hasn't changed.
Right.
Learning about the politics and learning about just, even for what I knew, like,
you just thought there was politics in the military. You had no idea what was outside the military, I'm sure.
Even knowing what I knew.
Right.
I mean, when I came in the first time around, I knew all the area directors. I'd either known them personally or in some professional manner at all the matches.
Right.
And even with that knowledge, you know, looking behind the curtain for the first time and going, oh, mm-hmm. That was a challenge.
I get it. Now you're in a situation where you're back as USPSA president, and I would love to sit down with you again later and discuss more things about that.
Of course.
But I want to discuss today your story. What got you here? What drives you? I think we learned a little bit about that today.
Yeah.
Is there anything we missed or left off about, you know, growing up and where you're at now?
No, that was
like
actually
growing up, not in the sport, growing up as through the sports in the situation.
It was actually a pretty broad base. Yeah. Well, I hadn't even thought about skydiving.
Yeah.
That was, I haven't thought about it in a really long time.
Right. I love your analogies you put together about how it all becomes self-conscious. I think that's neat.
Yes,
I learned a lot. So, well, you know, the message I take out of this is, if you're passionate about it, you really believe in it, then there's no reason to quit.
The sport is still good. I mean, here you are, Brian. I mean,
oh, I support
you've only
it.
You've only been in this, what, for 6 years?
I'm going in 6 years right now.
So you're about the same place I was,
yes,
you know, 6 years ago, where, I mean, just look at what you've done. You know, look at all the people that come by, everything. You know, they've been so appreciative for what you've done for the sport. You know, your wall of photos. You know, it's I think it's what we've always wanted. The people and fun.
I'm if I'm not having fun on the weekends, then I don't want to do it. That's why I'm in Florida, because it's cold. I don't like being cold.
Cold is not a good thing to be.
I like the warmth. You know, if you know, I'm sure, you know, I don't have to, normally I say this at this part of the podcast, if people want to find you, they know how to get in touch with you, but I think that's pretty much out there.
I think so too.
I think you're getting, I think you're staying very busy with people getting in touch with you. Are you excited about the challenge that lays ahead based on what you've experienced just so far in 2024? And it's only in February.
I am. I mean, it was certainly frustrating last week. You know, this week is there is a clearer path forward,
right,
for, you know, some positive change to occur. Well, it's not going to be as fast as people expect.
No, and this is not coming out probably, won't start season four until March. So this won't come out till later. But, you know, seeing stuff that we've all seen now that live stream has happened, you know, hopefully the live streams continue, because at some point they can be voted out. But hopefully they continue to keep holding people, not necessarily accountable, but hold people to a point of where people are watching to make sure you're doing what's best for the org.
And I think that's really the key at the end of the day.
Right.
You know, the live streaming definitely gave people a peek behind the curtain that was unexpected.
Right.
But again, the board and the organization serves the sport and the members.
Right.
So if we're doing things great, let us know. If we're not doing things not so great, we should know about that too.
Well, by the time this releases, I'm sure we'll be a lot further down the road than we are right now.
Hope so. That's the plan.
I don't have hope. I know what's going to happen. I stay very positive, and that's just, I'm just positive, positive vibes there. So I'm excited. I'm looking forward to the future as well. So if you have any questions for Yeeman, you know, of course, you know how to get in touch with him, and through the USPSA, and you know, he needs letters of support as well if he's doing good things. Yeman and I've had some conversations, and I see where he's going with a lot of good things in the future. So I'm hoping as this rolls out later in March that we are there and everything's there. But thank you so much for watching or listening to this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. And I am excited, you know, hopefully to sit down with Yeman a lot more in the future to get some more insights of what's going on and what I normally do behind the lens. But I wanted to start now with getting a baseline to know where he came from, because I really didn't know either. And, thank you so much for watching and listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens, and we will see you at the range soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
For a complete written transcript of the Dr. Bill Show, go online to www.icarusmusic.com.
And welcome back to the Dr. Bill Show. Let's go to a caller who seems to be having issues communicating with his girlfriend. Caller?
Yeah, I'd had this problem with my girlfriend. She kind of broke up with me. I've been doing everything right. Everything's been going great. We went out. We've gone out for, I don't know, I'd say a good 5-6 months. Everything's good. I mean...
But son, you've got to use communication.
I've done that. I mean, what else can I do? I mean, seriously, I mean, like...
Son. Some girls are just bitches.